Hi, this is Barry Levy, and I am the writer-performer of Hoaxacost, written and performed by Barry Levy with the generous assistance of the Institute for Political and International Studies, Tehran. And I am talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By, brought to you by UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends, my neighbors, my enemies, too. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am thrilled to be here talking about the Fringe. No, not the Fringe on my Dallas. I'm talking about the Fringe Festival that happens every summer in New York, the York of New, as I like to call it. And especially because every once in a while you get a Jewish play in there, which is exciting because all the rest are pretty much gay plays. Well, this is slightly gay, but it's mostly Jewish, and it's called, get ready for this title, it's called Hoaxacost. All right, put your guns down, put your knives down. This is a play, it's a one-man show by a nice Jewish boy named Barry Levy, who is talking about Holocaust denial and the insanity of it. So it's okay, folks. He's on our side. This man has also written some other plays. Those include All the Way from China, Woman of Troy, which is amazingly enough a comedy, and my favorite, Mushroom Chicken and the Women Who Make It. Good playwriting. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the neighborhood with me, Rabbi Saul, Barry Levy. Shalom, Barry.
Shalom, Rabbi. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm very pleased to. Now, let me ask you the most important question. What is your Hebrew name, Barry?
Benjamin.
That makes sense. Benjamin Levy. I like it. I like it. So, how Jewish are you?
I'm pretty Jewish. Jewish all sides of the tree, all the way back as far as I've ever traced it.
Are there any rabbis in the family? Any of that going on, or just
no rabbis in the family, but several rabbi friends. So I am familiar with the rabbinate, and I cherish my Jewish, my rabbi friends.
As well you should. Now, where's your family, your ancestry come from?
Poland and Russia, for the most part.
Yep. Depending on what month it was, it could have been a piece of Poland, or it could have been a piece of Russia, right?
Absolutely, that's what my grandfather always said. He could have been one or the other.
Now, before we get to Hoaxacost, let's talk about your early stages of playwriting, how you decided that you had to start putting things on paper and be a writer. How did this happen?
Like for a lot of people, I think it started being a child actor, right up until the point where my voice changed and I started singing terribly. And that was pretty much the end of my musical theater career.
Now, when you said you were a child actor, was that professionally or just in junior high school, etc.?
Community theater, not professional, but some very good community theater, if I do say so myself. I was an excellent Von Trapp child and an excellent Lost Boy in Peter Pan. Even the Artful Dodger and Oliver, I think, was one of my finer hours.
Oh, Artful Dodger, I would have pegged you more for an Oliver, but an Artful Dodger, okay.
Yeah, and that was, I think, the last thing right before puberty hit. That was pretty much the end. I think there was one ill-fated attempt to do Bye Bye Birdie in the middle of puberty, and that really,
Kids! What to do about kids today? No, that's not gonna...
What's the number?
Yeah.
That was the number. So, so after that, I'd always really liked writing, and it just never occurred to me in my early childhood that one could write for the theater. And when I sort of figured that out, I started taking playwriting classes at the Cleveland Playhouse.
Oh, nice.
The next thing you knew, I pretty much settled on playwriting is what I wanted to do.
Who did you study with? Josephine Apathy? Who did you study at the Playhouse with there?
A wonderful teacher named Joanne Durante, who I'm still in touch with today and is still teaching today and is an excellent, excellent teacher.
Is she related to Jimmy Durante?
I don't think so. I don't think so. She certainly sounded nothing like him.
I kind of do. I've been told that. And I even have a longer nose, which is even worse. But anywho, Barry Levy here about his playwriting. So, Hoaxacost, it's being done now, but you've been working on this thing for how long? A long time, no?
The director and I were just realizing that the first iteration of Hoaxacost was actually 5 years ago. He is a wonderful director named Jeremy Gold Cronenberg, also clearly a member of the tribe, who was working with a theater called the Prospect Theater Company. A slot called they have a Dark Knight series where they bring in plays for just a weekend. And he was directing a slot there and asked me if I had anything I was working on. And at the time, I had an idea for this play that was going to be an epic adventure with a cast of hundreds, this Dan Brown, Indiana Jones style, tracking these Holocaust deniers all over the world, and I pitched my epic vision to Jeremy, and he said, that is great. Now can you do it as a one-man show?
Did you immediately say, yes, did a light bulb go off? Or did you go, oh, no, 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 and 6 months later, you were like, oh, maybe I can.
I immediately said yes, because I never say no to getting a show done. But then afterwards, I said, no, 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 how am I ever going to do this? And started plotting. But then he talked me through it. He talked me off the ledge a few times, and we ended up with something really great that we did do for Prospect Theater Company at 59 East 59th Street. Then we did it again at The Cell in a sort of developmental version. And then we just did it again 2 summers ago at Theater for the New City and had a couple really great runs.
I assume at some point you would love to have an off-Broadway run for the piece, you know, find the producer and plunk down for a while. Or I think I read somewhere a show like this would almost be more like The Accidental Pervert, where you would do it once or twice a week, week after week after week after week, right?
Yeah, something like that would be great. It would be really ideal.
Well,
it's kind of a fun test now in The Fringe, because we sort of envision it as maybe sort of a late night piece after maybe another show has been done, and my slots in The Fringe are right around then, some 9 o'clock slots, which might be a perfect test for that kind of a run for it.
And I assume, therefore, if it's going to be a late night piece after other shows, it's minimal set, minimal. Do you use projections, or is it just you lighting a chair, blah, blah, blah?
It is a bench and me and some lighting, and the rest is all special effects conjured by storytelling.
Very, very nice. Well, I would say nice, except it's not a nice subject. It would be enough for me to sit down and watch a show of you just saying, okay, I talked to this Holocaust denier, these are the crazy things they said, then I talked to another Holocaust denier, these are the crazy things they said, but your show goes beyond that. In what ways?
Exactly what you just said is sort of was exactly how I thought it was maybe going to go at the beginning, and that was one of my challenges. I thought, okay, so, you know, these deniers will say things that are so ludicrous, so ridiculous, it'll be hysterical, but, you know, that might get boring. But anyway, it'll be funny, let's see what happens. And then the more I learned, the more I realized that, you know, this stuff isn't actually just funny, this stuff is terrifying. Some of the things they say are, you know, can be ludicrous, like...
Or any other rapper, for that matter. I'm sorry.
Someone can say something like, oh, yeah, all the people they say died in the Holocaust actually just went underground and live in Brooklyn now. And, you know, that kind of thing is just preposterous, and that's easy enough to laugh off. But then if people start giving you, you know, fake facts, you know, things that sound like facts and are just completely made up, they'll tell you something like the Anne Frank diary was written with a pen that used a kind of ink that wasn't even invented until 1953, and they'll give you all these specifics. Someone who doesn't know that that's a completely made-up fact, it sounds, you know, if you just saw that on the internet and you were, you know, maybe not so well-educated in the subject, you might say, oh, wow, I didn't know that. That must mean that it's a lie. It got really scary. It got really scary really fast, and that ended up giving me sort of the arc of the piece so that it's not as boring and repetitive as you said. It sort of moves from being lighthearted and funny look at this to a really scary and challenging look at this.
The thing is, you move towards, I mean, I haven't seen the show, but from what I've read, you move it towards fiction and fantasy in a way that goes beyond even what these people were telling you. Am I right?
At the same time, as it gets scarier and scarier and away from the ridiculous, some of the storytelling elements do move from the more realistic to the more ridiculous. You're right, there's sort of an inverse thing going on, but yeah. The amount of things that are 100% true is always sort of a difficult thing in storytelling, because just by telling a story, we change it a little bit and we heighten some things. And I was very mindful of, you know, Mike Daisy, another monologuist, who told a true story about Apple, and then some things, what things are composites and what things aren't, proved to be a very tricky issue for him. So I do make sure that by the end of the show, I think people are very, very aware of what exactly happened and what maybe didn't so much happen.
Because I have to say, that was bothering me a little bit about going towards the end of this show, where at first the audience members watching this and going, okay, these lunatics have said these things, but wait a minute, now he's throwing all this stuff that he's made up. What did the lunatics say? And now, if they're not really saying that, is this all made up? But you're saying that, at least the way you've crafted this show, the audience is going to be pretty clear about what were actual quotes from crazy people.
I believe so, yes. That is certainly the intent of the piece, and we've worked on it long enough, and I think we've gotten the balance right.
Now, how did you go about meeting these lunatics?
You know, about 5 years ago when we started working on the piece, it was sort of the first time I started noticing lots. There's certainly a lot of stories about Holocaust denial in the news. It started there. I just started reading what some people said and then started, you know, to take my inquiries a little further.
Were these all phone calls, or did you physically visit people, or what?
I don't want to give away too much of what, the adventure in the show of how I get in touch with these people, but some of it was research, a lot of different kinds of research. But I'll tell you this, it's difficult to find. I think there's a very rational, well thought out resistance to publicizing what deniers say because we don't want to give these people a platform. You know, we don't want to help them spread their nonsense. But at the same time, I found it sort of scary to not know, you know, not be able to combat it if I don't know exactly what they're saying. So it became important to me to really find out.
At the same time, you know what's easy? You click on any story about Israel or in the news on Yahoo or CNN or wherever or the Huffington Post, and you start reading the comments on the story, you will find anti-Semites, Holocaust deniers, and anti-Zionists left and right on there. You can find them real easy, and they have no problem getting their message out. You just can't find who they are for real because they have avatars and they've got different names.
The comment sections on the internet are one of the most terrifying places I think that exist, and I do make reference to those in the show. So yeah, the internet's a scary place.
Well, you keep talking about scary, scary, scary. Were you ever fearful of your own person when and if, I guess, you met any of these people in person?
I got scared, I mentioned before, like the sort of Anne Frank diary fact. I got scared when I would hear things and I would say, you know, I could see myself if I was not educated about these things and skeptical about these things. I could see myself if I were a different person in a different situation swallowing that line. And that was very scary for me. And there was another point, you know, there's like all these number games people play about, and this also makes its way into the show, but, you know, comparing and contrasting numbers of people in different genocides, and it can become this whole sort of Glenn Beck magic blackboard sort of thing where you don't even realize, you know, the facts and figures get so messed up and you get so turned around that it suddenly becomes this very convincing, weird pseudoscience. And I did catch myself at one point being like, wait a minute, those numbers don't add up. That doesn't make sense, before I had to catch myself and say, well, that's because the whole thing was based on fuzzy math. And you go back through. And
at the same time, I have to say that there was a thing a couple of weeks or months ago where there was one story about the Holocaust where they said 6 million was a low number, and that it was closer to 8 or 10 or something like that. So, and suddenly that comes out there, and you're like, well, do I want to believe that? Or is that as nutty as the people are saying it was much, much less than 6 million? I don't know if you've seen that story or that item.
I haven't seen the newest item you're talking about, but, you know, that comes up a lot, you know, the number, the specific number, and some people, some deniers like to try to make hay out of the idea that, oh, the number keeps changing, or no one's sure exactly how many, but when you think about it, it actually makes much more sense for us to argue over exactly how many and to get it just right than to always say, oh, it was exactly 6 million to the number, on the nose. I mean, of course, we're going to go back and forth about the exact total. That's evidence of diligence in getting it right more than it's some made-up figure.
Were you ever able to come up with a thought or an idea of why all these people feel the need to deny the level of the Holocaust or deny it entirely? What is so important to them that they have to do this?
You know, I actually have never successfully answered that question for myself other than... I keep coming back from those basic things, thinking I'll find something more complex and more complicated. But really, I, you know, the only thing that makes sense to me is the most simple answers of needing to scapegoat people, you know, needing someone to scapegoat and needing to deny someone's past and someone's humanity and someone's victimization in order to be able to scapegoat them for something. And that's not just the Jews that happens to, but in this instance, that is who it's happening to and who it's happened to for a very long time. And I think denying the Holocaust is just one more way of doing that.
But I'm sure that at least half the people that you talk to would say, oh, no, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm not anti-Jew, not even anti-Israel, I just want the truth. Do you hear that shit a lot?
That is something that gets said a lot, right? We just need to, right, this is just about getting the history right. It's just about evidence, and it's just about, exactly what you just said.
We are talking, by the way, with Barry Levy. He is the writer and performer of a show that sounds, as you can hear, very, very interesting, called Hoaxocaust, Hoaxocaust. It's going to be playing at 64 East 4th Underground. I know it's a ridiculous name for a theater, but it tells you exactly where the hell it is, 64 East 4th Street. And it's playing, it's just doing a couple of shows because it's part of the Fringe Festival, but you can catch it on August 15th at 9:15, Saturday the 16th at 2:45 in the afternoon. What the, can't they just do on the hour? Can they make this any more complicated? Jesus Christ.
There's a lot of shows to organize in the Fringe. It's a huge festival.
That's true, but shit, they can't just have it on the half hour, the hour, this 45, this 15. Why don't you just have it everything at 18 after the hour?
Probably my fault. It's probably because, you know, if I had told them the show was exactly an hour and a half, I maybe would have gotten that, but I had to go and tell them it was an hour and 15 minutes.
That's it, so they can log somebody. I get it.
I sealed my own fate.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, if you want to see Barry Levy's fate, he's also on Sunday the 17th at 2, and Tuesday the 19th at 6. And you know what? Just go to fringenyc.org. Fringenyc.org, and you can see the dates that Hoax Show cost is going to be playing. But we're talking about the present and the past. Let's talk about the past of Barry Levy. The one thing, when I asked you about being a playwright, and first you were a child actor, but you mentioned in another interview that Stephen Sondheim was important to your becoming a theater person. How is this?
Sure, he founded an incredible organization called Young Playwrights that, you know, finds and produces work by high school students and younger. Nationwide initiative, but then they bring students to New York. They also have a citywide initiative, and I think they have, you know, it's expanded a lot since I was in it. I think they actually have sister cities that do this also. But they bring kids to New York and produce their work and get them working with professional directors and professional actors and dramaturgs, and it's just this really eye-opening thing that lets you know, I can do this.
Well, so you had a play done at Young Playwrights?
I did. I was a finalist 1 year where they brought us all in, the seven of us or whatever, all had staged readings. But there were no actual productions that year. I think it was financial hard times. So I won't say I had a full production, but I had a wonderful, wonderful stage reading directed by Daniel Fish. That was of Mushroom Chicken and the Women Who Make It. And it was really an incredible experience. And yeah, Sondheim founded that thing. So in addition to being a musical theater kid who geeked out on Sondheim growing up, I have him to thank for making me a New York playwright for the first time.
It's funny, I didn't even know the answer to that question when I asked it. I assumed you were just going to be talking about the fact that the first show that really clicked with you, that made you realize how wonderful theater was Into the Woods. That was the answer I was expecting. I'm so glad I asked.
You're not far off. That was one of the first, that did tour the Playhouse Square Center in Cleveland when I was a kid, and my parents did take me. I think it started Cleo Lane as the witch, and I think that was the first big Broadway touring shows I saw.
Well, do you remember the first play you ever saw?
The very first play I ever saw, I don't. I have memories of my aunt taking me to, you know, a children's theater production of Annie when I was very small. I don't remember the very first one, but Into the Woods was among them, probably The Music Man. I will say,
what?
Much to my parents' chagrin, I gravitated more away from the clean lines of The Music Man and more towards the Act 2 Armageddon of Into the Woods. That was definitely more my style.
Indeed. Well, if you're doing a play called Hoax of Cost, we can see where the Armageddon part is coming from. Let me tell you. Well, since we're talking still Holocaust, a question then we're all asking ourselves, we've been asking ourselves since 1946, is the modern Jew too closely defined and connected to the Holocaust? It's sort of like New Yorkers in Lower Manhattan defining themselves by 9/11, even though it's a much, much smaller kind of a thing. They don't. I mean, they're New Yorkers, they remember it's a horrible thing, but it's this compartmentalized event. Whereas the modern Jew tends to use the Holocaust as a touchstone for almost everything. What are your thoughts?
That is exactly one of the questions I was having when I started writing the play. I was wondering how big a role should that play in my identity, and finding that I sort of chafed a little bit at how big of a role it played, I felt, in my family and in my community. One of the questions I ask, you know, in the play, if someone decides to intermarry, and I've heard this in my life, someone saying, well, no, Jews have to marry Jews because of the Holocaust, right? Because otherwise we're killing Jews off and we're finishing what Hitler started. And, you know, you hear that kind of thing, and you, on the one hand, understand where it comes from, and on the other hand, you say, well, you know, is that letting this event define ourselves too much? I wrestle with that, and I wrestle with that in the play.
And you wrestle, apparently, as you said, in your family. Is it true your brother married or wanted to marry an Arab girl?
Once again, I kind of like the play speak for itself, but
I didn't know that was part of the plan.
It has come up in my life with family, with friends, and people really do wrestle with these things in real life.
You don't have to say how if you're saying it's in the play. I know you want to keep the play and not tell any secrets or anything, but has it been resolved satisfactorily?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Well, I mean, as far as the overarching question of how large a role should the Holocaust play in forming our sort of contemporary identities, I don't know if I've resolved that question satisfactorily yet. But I will say my family is all well and happy. Everyone loves each other very much. So as far as that's concerned, yes, that has been resolved.
Now, I don't know if this is in the play either. You know, I can ask you your favorite color. If it's in the play, I still want you to tell me the goddamn answer, if you don't mind. But
I'm colorblind, so you're going to have a tough time getting that one out of me.
That is tough. All right, fair enough. But let's say you've got this happy but fairly traditional Jewish family. How did they react when you came out?
When I came out as writing a play about Holocaust deniers, or when I came out as gay? Because there were reactions to both.
Okay, both.
coming out as gay was actually not so terrible. I have a very supportive family. You know, they've been great. It wasn't an instantaneous gay pride parade around my neighborhood, but we got there, and communication was always open, and they're extremely supportive. They always have been, and they get more so each and every day.
Well, that's lovely.
And the Holocaust denier thing was actually maybe a little bit harder.
Hmm.
I actually decamped to my parents' house in Ohio to write the first draft of the play, and they were very worried. They would see me hunched over the table, you know, assembling all my notes and all my research, and they would look over my shoulder and, you know, say, oi, 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 oi.
What did they say they were worried about? Were they afraid that the play would be not perceived as anti-Semitic but cause anti-Semitism?
No, I think they worried more about, you know, that idea of, you know, why give people a platform? Why let anyone know what these people are saying? I don't think they ever feared for my sort of moral compass, but I do think they worried about, you know, there's a reason that we don't, you know, that in an article we'll say, oh, Le Pen is a Holocaust denier, but we won't say, and in fact, here's how he explains World War II. But, you know, I just talked to them about how I actually felt like it was important to know what they're saying so that we can combat it. You know, it's, again, you know, when I found myself faced with that kind of nonsense about the diary and the pen and the ink, you know, I found it very important to learn enough about it to be able to say, well, the diary was authenticated by the Netherlands State Forensic Lab, and I didn't know that before I was confronted with the need to defend it, you know? So I explained it to them, and also I think they worried a little bit about the factual basis, and like you asking about my brother, and, you know, they worried about putting all that stuff out there. But they have seen the play, and they're very proud, and they're very supportive of the play now, as well as my sexuality. So all is well in my family.
This is good. And amazingly enough, my family, too. And I did a one-man show in New York, too, about 2 years ago called Shalom Dammit, An Evening With Me. And people were so worried, oh, you're saying such terrible things, and you're making jokes about Jews, and this. And then they saw it, and they still despised me as a person, but they respected my work. Which I thought was important. Let me ask you, and one more question about the gay thing, but I'm curious about this now. Are you dating only Jewish people?
No, I am not dating only Jewish people. I've been dating the same non-Jewish person for 14 years now.
Oh, mit Mazel, mit Glück. Okay, are you going to get married?
I don't know. We may have,
and if you get married and
you
decide to adopt, would you raise the child as Jewish?
That's another great question. I would certainly raise any child I had Jewish. That's not to say that the child might not also be raised with other cultural backgrounds and religious touchstones. You know, what is raising a Jewish child is a difficult question. Are we talking raising a child with Judaism as a religion, Judaism as a culture? Is Judaism the child's ethnicity? If you know, depending how the child was born.
Wait. All right, that's a
good question.
I mean, I know this is all hypothetical, but let's do a hypothetical reality here. And let's say you get married, and if your partner were a Baptist and you wanted the child baptized, would you be okay with this?
You know, this is why I may just stick with dogs. This is all very complicated. right now, I will say that I have two chihuahuas who are not baptized.
Are they circumcised?
Not circumcised.
Oh,
so
well, yeah, yeah.
Really, it's up in the air. It's up in the air what their religious affiliation is.
So you do grapple. We all grapple, of course. And let me ask you, of the people, and again, I'm sorry this is in the play, but I'm going to ask, of these Holocaust deniers that you talked to, were any of them Jewish?
I did not speak with any Jewish Holocaust deniers, and there's no Jewish Holocaust deniers who make their way into the play. Although there is an oblique reference, deniers do like to tell the story of a survivor, a Jewish survivor, who went on the record as saying that his camp at Buchenwald was like a country club, and it was beautiful and it was wonderful, and no bad things happened there. Of course, researchers all say survivor testimony is completely psychological and reliable, and they don't use it. They don't use anyone's for the basis of their factual findings. So just because there's this one outlier who knows what his story is, there's also, of course, all the plentiful others who would tell a very different story, and none of their eyewitness testimonies is considered the main evidence in support of anything. So, but they do like to trot that. They do like to trot that little factoid out.
Now, I'm also curious about, since one of the things that parents are worried about, and you were worried about, getting all this information out there and shining a light on these cockroaches, what has audience reaction been? Have they come up to you after the show? Did any not get it? Were these people who would sit through the Borat movie and not realize it was a spoof?
Yes, I do feel like, rarely, but if you ask has it ever happened, it has, and there have often been talkbacks after the show, and so on the one hand, it's, you know, it can be terrifying for me to say, uh-oh, this is someone raises their hand, and they didn't get it, and I'm like, oh no, have I not made it clear enough, but then 45 other people in the audience will turn to that person and say, you know, what did you just see, because it was very clear to me where this play comes down on the issue, and so I figured, okay, so if, you know, 44 out of the 45 people, it's very clear, and they can talk to the one person who didn't get it, I think maybe it's okay.
Did you ever get a Holocaust denier in the audience?
I don't know if I've ever had a Holocaust denier in the audience. There was one person once that I was a little worried could have been, but I don't know that for a fact. And I don't came up to me afterwards and tried to ask me some very strange questions. And then I just, there were plenty of other people there who I needed to talk to, and I just sort of ignored this person because he was making me feel a little uncomfortable. So there could have been one.
Should have sent him to Old Jews Telling Jokes. He would have been much happier, I think. We're talking with a middle-aged, Joel Loma, how old are you?
I am 36 right now, I think 37 in October.
Okay, middle-aged Jew telling stories. That's basically, I will we'll talk to Barry Levy here. Just another quick question or two, the very obvious one. You've been working on this particular play, now, you know, revising it and working it, now you're doing it again, but what else are you working on?
I am working on, I think you mentioned earlier, one of my newer plays is called Woman of Troy, which is completely different, Megillah, from this one. It is a historical comedy about the woman who wrote the Iliad. It supposes a woman Homer, and it's a little bit like a funny thing happened on the way to the phoneme or something. It's an ancient, archaic Greece, a little bit of some anachronistic yucks, and a chorus who enacts the Iliad in counterpoint to her sort of life and death struggle to get it written on parchment for the first time, and that's been a lot of fun.
Do you only write comedies?
Yeah, you know, even when I try to write something really serious, it ends up being a little bit funny. I don't know what that's about, but and the opposite. Every time I try to write something just funny, like I thought Hoaxacost was going to be at first, it turns out to be a little bit serious. So somehow I come down right in the middle. Dramedy, comedy, I don't know.
Comedy, I like that. Comedy. Now, well, the other question I want to ask you is, theater is a harsh and tough mistress. You know, 1% of the population makes a good living at it. So, you know, you write plays, you're getting them done, that's wonderful, and you've been doing it for a long time, but do you have a day job? What's your support system?
I work as an administrative assistant in a law office, and it's been a very rewarding not to have to worry about whether or not I'm making my rent or maintenance with playwriting, because that would be a very, very difficult proposition.
Do you foresee a time when you'll be able to do part-time or curtail, or do you think you'll be doing admin for a while?
I certainly don't have any plans to leave it right now. I mean, we'll see. If Hoaxacost turns into a Broadway musical,
there we go.
Then perhaps, but I don't see that as being in the cards for the show, so I'm certainly, as they say, not quitting my day job anytime soon.
Does Hoaxacost have an exclamation point after it?
It does. It has to.
Because if it didn't, that's what it would need for a musical. It might have to add another exclamation point, like two of them.
Right.
And then
right.
The musical after it.
Those are one for the lyricist. Yes, as many exclamation points as a title can take, I usually like to throw in there.
Well, I have been very, very delighted and overjoyed, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, to talk with the smart, the delightful Barry Levy. I want to remind people that if you want to see Hoaxacost, and I imagine after hearing this interview you will, It's at 64E4 Underground. You can tell where that is. Use your brain. It's starting on Friday night, the 15th, at 9:15 in the evening. Then there's on Saturday, there's a show on Sunday. Then Tuesday, and the last one is Thursday, August 21st, at 9:30 in the evening. Go to fringenyc.org for all the information on this play, as well as the other plays in the New York International Fringe Festival. And do you live in Cleveland, or are you in New York?
I'm in New York.
Oh, so you can work while doing the show, pretty much.
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Well, it has been delightful, Benjamin. You're Benjamin? What's your father's name?
Father's name is Harold.
Oh, what was his Hebrew? Is his Hebrew name?
Oh, God, I don't know, Rabbi. Now the questions are getting harder. We're about to sign off, and now
I was going to ask you to recite your Haftorah portion. Oh, no. Oh, well.
Omer Adonai El Elyon. That's about as much as...
Oh, you have a nice voice. Have you ever done Since Your Voice Changed musicals again?
I haven't, but if you could find me one where the role is, you know, limited to that 3-note range, I just might have a shot.
Well, if we ever turn this radio show into a musical, you'll be the first one I call. Barry Levy, a delight. Thank you so much. Best of luck with your show and with all the work that you're doing. Shalom to you.
Shalom to you. Thank you again, Rabbi. Bye-bye.